This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. If you've ever gone downhill skiing, you've surely seen the detailed maps showing all the different runs, the chalet, the parking lots, and so on. The ones that look like they were hand-drawn and painted with a really fine brush. And they look usually really cool. Have you ever stopped to think about the work that goes into making something like that? Our next guest knows a thing or two, or 430, about that. He's created at least that many maps for ski resorts all over the world, even one here in Wisconsin. James Niehuis is a ski resort map artist based in Colorado. The author of the new coffee table book, The Man Behind the Maps, legendary ski artist James Niehuis, which came out this year. He was inducted into the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame for his map-making prowess this year as well. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Well, it's good to be here.
How did you get started creating these ski resort maps?
I was looking for a job. I was working the streets in Denver as a freelance artist, and it was getting kind of tough. So I looked up Bill Brown, thinking he might have some extra work, and he's the previous trail map illustrator. And it turned out really good. I walked in looking for some work and really walked out with a career. He looked at my portfolio, liked what he saw, and he was wanting to move on to another passion that he had.
Walk us through the process of how you make one of these resort trail maps.
Well, whenever I first get a job, I'll go on Google Earth today. Didn't used to do that 30 years ago, but I'll get on Google Earth and review the resort with the different perspectives that I can find there. And then once I really know it, I'll give them a quote, and I'll the next step would be to get aerial photographs. So if the ski area is a small ski area, why, they'll send me aerial photographs that I will direct them into the necessary views that I want. And once I get them, then I'll go into a full-size sketch. It's a real detailed sketch, and I'll send that off for approval or alterations. And once I receive that back, that image is directly transferred onto the drawing board, and the painting starts.
It seems like one of the challenges here is you want something really practical that, you know, the skier can use to figure out where they want to ski, but you also want to have something that's really aesthetically appealing, as we find out when we look at your book and look at the art here. How do you balance those two things?
I put top priority on both. Always have. I've felt that the accuracy is of the utmost importance, of course, for the skier to understand where he is on the mountain, but also to understand where he is on the mountain. It's important to get all the deciduous and conifer trees in their correct position, show rocks and different things, and that all comes into the category of aesthetics and just the beauty of the piece. It's an interpretation. So the skiers out in the great outdoors enjoying time on the mountain, and so that's what I try to capture.
Talking to James Niehuis, he's a ski map artist based in Colorado. His new book is The Man Behind the Maps, legendary ski artist James Niehuis, that came out this year. As you're making all these maps for so many years, did you ever think of them being collected as they are now in a book of art, basically?
Oh, yes. During the mid-1990s, I realized I'd done quite a few, and that perhaps perhaps someday maybe they could be put in a book. I always thought it'd make a great coffee table book and have interest all across the states with the ski areas. And so I had written it into my contract that I would have the book rights, and since that day, my contracts have changed, and I own the rights to them. So there are a few ski areas that I've done in the early 1990s that are not in the book, just because I couldn't get the rights to put it in. Couldn't get their approvals.
You are there in Colorado. That's where you're based. You got a lot of skiing there. We don't have that much skiing in Wisconsin, but we do have some. And people who have skied at Devil's Head Resort north of Merrimack have seen your work in action. Do you remember anything about your one big job here in Wisconsin?
Well, that's the only job that I've, the only trail map that I've painted in Wisconsin. But Devil's Head was a very interesting one. It is probably interesting because there's a challenge in just the amount of deciduous trees there are, and the challenge is to make them interesting and put some color variation in them and get the feel of the area. So I worked from aerial photographs that they supplied. I did not visit Devil's Head. And that's fairly typical with medium to smaller ski area.
Now, have you been a skier yourself over the years?
I kind of learned on the job. When I first got into trail map making, I really could not ski very well at all. And so I became an intermediate after a few years and did enjoy the slopes for many years. But I still ski with fear on those steep slopes. and by steep, it's not really steep, but for me it certainly is.
You're still more advanced than I am. Now, your career, as you say, has been in ski trail maps. You're an artist in general. Do you still do other kinds of art just for fun outside of the trail maps?
I grew up in Colorado, so I've done a lot of hiking as a kid and hunting in the mountains, and so I really admired and painted the mountains whenever I was very small, and so I do oils today, and I have probably I have thousands of photographs on my computer that I want to get to someday and paint.
Well, I hope you can get out to Wisconsin sometime and paint some of our nature, though I can't promise you a lucrative career as a ski map artist here in this state.
Well, it's true, but I really enjoy the small areas too. You know, I've done some very small ski areas, and I try to price it so that it's not out of the question for them, and I enjoy doing them.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Rob, because I've enjoyed this too.
James Niehues is a ski resort map artist based in Colorado, author of the coffee table book, The Man Behind the Maps. Legendary ski artist James Niehues came out this year. We talked with him about how he creates these maps, including the one for Devil's Head Resort north of Madison. You can see some of his work at his website, James Niehues, that's niehues.com. Coming up, we'll talk about how you and your family can avoid getting scammed out of a gift card this holiday season. That's coming up on Central Time. Now the holidays are upon us. That means you'll likely be purchasing presents for your friends and family, maybe even yourself. And gift cards are really popular this time of year because of their convenience for the buyer and flexibility for the recipient. But gift cards can come with some risks. Our next guest tells us how to protect your gift card purchase and avoid scams and schemes this holiday season. Tiffany Bernhardt-Schultz is the Southwest Wisconsin Regional Director for the Wisconsin Better Business Bureau. Tiffany, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how pervasive are various kinds of gift card scams?
Well, you really want to be careful when you're out there purchasing a gift card because scammers are using gift cards as a form of payment because they're untraceable. So there's a scam that's going on right now where scammers are going to gift card walls such as Walmart, Walgreens, Target, wherever you can buy a gift card, and they're scratching off the back of those gift card numbers and the PIN number, and they're just waiting for that gift card to be purchased. So as soon as it's purchased, that the funds are gone on it. So when you purchase a gift card, you really want to be careful looking at the packaging and making sure that it's not tampered with.
So we want to see something that looks like it's sealed up and maybe look at the back of the gift card even after we open it up and make sure it hasn't been altered in any way?
Right, absolutely. Look at that packaging for any tears, wrinkles, or any other indications of tampering, and see if that PIN number is exposed too. If there is anything suspicious with the gift card, it's best to take a different card and give that card to the store's customer service desk, the one that's tampered with.
And are stores trying to get a handle on this? Obviously, people are walking in, altering products on their shelves in front of their eyes, more or less.
Well, it is something that, you know, everybody needs to be aware of, especially during this time of year where people are purchasing gift cards for the holiday season and the number of gift cards that are being sold at retailers. So, yes, the retailers, you know, do need to get behind this and educate themselves on what's happening in their stores.
If I give or receive a card that turns out to have been, in effect, pre-drained by scammers, is there anything I could do about it?
Well, you should go back to the issuer on that card, take it back. Some retailers will go ahead and, you know, possibly reimburse funds. Some may not. Sometimes there may be a fee to do that. So it basically falls down into, you know, the card issuer and how they're going to handle that.
Now, even when a card is legitimate and hasn't been tampered with, in a press release you say, be careful, check out the rules and restrictions on how you can use that card. What should we watch for?
Well, sometimes those cards will start to deduct funds on them, so you want to make sure that you use that gift card right away. Sometimes you can only use it at certain locations. For example, if you do receive an American Express gift card, not all retailers accept American Express, so that's something to watch out for as well. If the retailer is close to bankruptcy or filing bankruptcy, that gift card may be worth less than anticipated or nothing at all. So you really want to spend those gift cards right away and be wary that you have them. You want to treat them like cash, be protective of them, and you don't want to just, you know, lay something, you know, put something that has a value on it where anybody can take it.
I understand that some gift cards can be registered. I don't think I've ever done that myself. I don't know how to do it or what it means. What is gift card registration?
Sometimes a retailer allows the consumer to register their gift card, so we do encourage consumers to take full advantage of that. It makes it easier to protect the balance, and you can report it sooner and potentially end up saving money that is stored on the card if you registered a gift card. And you would be able to find that information on the terms and conditions if that was an option to do.
And Tiffany, it seems like more and more each year gift cards are the gift of choice. Is that still true in 2019, or are we starting to see that change?
We're starting to see that change. Gift cards are no longer the number one gift to give. Although they're still popular, it's dropped down from that number one gift. And the reason being is because consumers no longer wish to receive gift cards that are due to the increasing amount of fraud that are out there. So they're being careful on the gifts that they're asking for, and that gift card is not taking the number one spot anymore.
On the note of gift cards, not necessarily ones we buy as gifts, there are scams out there where people claim to be often the Social Security agency or other federal agencies. They try to scam people out of money, saying their account is frozen. And the end game is they ask you to buy gift cards and then give them the numbers. That's something that's never going to be legit if somebody claiming to be a government employee asks you to pay in gift cards, right?
That's correct. That's an increasing tactic that fraudsters are using to get payment. Gift cards are untraceable, so they're the preferred form of payment. But if you think about it, the IRS, the FBI, the police department, any type of hospital or government agency doesn't accept gift cards as payment. And if you're asked to scratch off the numbers on the back of a card and send them by text message, email, phone, you can pretty much guarantee that that is a scam and you should just hang up on that scam.
And Tiffany, before I let you go, any other thoughts on safe shopping in the holiday season?
Just be very careful. Do your research when you're out there. The average consumer is expected to spend $1,048 this year on holiday shopping. So do your research and know and understand what you're buying before, you know, you give it as a gift. We all like to give, but we need to give with our head and not with our heart.
Tiffany, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Tiffany Bernhard-Schultz is the Southwest Wisconsin Regional Director for the Wisconsin Better Business Bureau. She joined us today to talk about how to avoid scams, especially with gift cards, this holiday season. Coming up after the news, the number of immigrant farm workers in the state has grown over the years. Now they're essential to the dairy business. We'll look at what life is like for people who left their homes for work in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Despite thousands of farm closures in recent years, milk production in Wisconsin is high and dairy remains the state's signature industry in many ways. That's thanks in large part to workers who immigrate here from Mexico and Central America. Their share of the farming labor force has grown over the last few decades. Today, they're considered essential to the dairy business. But long hours and dangerous conditions are the norm for some of those workers, many of whom are undocumented and living apart from their families. Maria Perez is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She recently wrote about immigrant farm workers in Wisconsin as part of the paper's Dairyland in Distress series. Maria, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
It can be hard to get good data on this, it sounds like, but do we have a sense of how much of the labor force on Wisconsin farms is made up of immigrants?
Well, as you said, you're right. It's very difficult to get any data. The last study was about a decade ago, and it said then that over 40% of the workers were immigrants. It didn't ask for immigration status. Right now, by talking to workers, if you hear them tell it, it's most of the workers in Wisconsin dairy farms are immigrants, and the vast majority are undocumented.
Well, and this, I think, sums it up very well. One farmer you talked to in Merrill who hires some of these immigrants, he said if all undocumented farmers were deported, he said, quote, we would have dead cows piled up in our farms. So it sounds like the farmers themselves really are relying on immigrant workers.
Yeah, and there are not a lot of farmers who are willing to speak about the issue, but those who do, they know or they seem to believe that without immigrants, their farms would not be able to operate because they wouldn't find workers to do the work.
And yeah, you talk to farmers about, you know, how few Americans, how few native-born Wisconsin workers actually show up to even apply for jobs or stay for those jobs if hired.
Right. These are, you must understand, these are really hard jobs. They can be exhausting. You may have to be milking cows for 12 hours a day. There may be like a day off a week. And the pay that we have more or less seen by anecdotal evidence is $10, $11, up to $13 an hour. In addition, these are rural areas that oftentimes are losing population, working age population. So, yeah, what farmers say is that it's very difficult to find native workers, and even when there is an applicant, they may not even, like, hold on for a second day of work.
For a lot of workers who immigrate to Wisconsin for work, their families stay behind, many of them in Mexico. And you talk to some of the farmers and their families about the stories. Can you talk about the decision to often separate from families to come up here to Wisconsin and try to earn money?
Well, it's a really, really hard decision. These workers are leaving behind their aging parents, their wives, their husbands, their children. They may be in Wisconsin for 5 years and only be able to see and grow their kids through phone calls, through video calls. But for them, while talking to them, it was more like, we have no other option. This is the only way that we can build a home. This is the only way that we can save to maybe start a business in the future. This is the only way for me to provide a good future for my family. So it's a really tough, hard decision for both the families and the workers, but they see it as something that is unavoidable, something that they really need to do if they want to progress in their lives and have a more or less a stable financial future.
And that might surprise some people. The goal for at least some of the farmers you talk to who came up from Mexico is not ultimately necessarily to stay in the United States. Some of them, many of them, it sounds like, are trying to earn enough money to, as you say, build a home and build something, build a life back in their hometowns.
Correct. Well, there are farm workers who stay in Wisconsin and settle down here. There are also many others who don't want to stay here, who miss their families, miss their parents, miss their hometowns and their culture. So their goal is just to save, to be able to like guarantee for themselves and their families a good future, and then go back. And while they're here, they just work, work, work. They try to spend as little as possible and send as much as they can to their hometowns, to their home countries, so they can come back soon and have the life that they wanted for themselves and for their families.
Talking to Maria Perez, investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She wrote one part in a longer series about the dairy industry in Wisconsin. She focuses on immigrants in the Wisconsin farm workforce. Maria, there are guest worker visas, I understand, for farm work, but they're only allowed for seasonal work. Is that right?
Correct. There is a program that is called H2A. That allows mostly growers to hire workers abroad and bring them for a few months, but those are not available for year-round jobs. Now, that program is a little problematic, too, because it leaves workers prone to abuse because their visas are tied to the employer that brings them here. They may, although recruiting fees are illegal, they may be required to pay recruiting fees. And that leaves them in a vulnerable position that may make them less reluctant to protest abuse at work. But obviously, there are also good employers, right? But yeah, this program is only available to growers who have seasonal jobs.
Right. So if I have a seasonal crop and I need workers for a month for the harvest, that might work. The dairy industry is not a seasonal crop. It's year round.
Correct. That is correct.
Our
farmers need to milk cows all year round.
Are farmers or farm groups looking for changes to that guest worker visa program?
Yes, they are. They have been traditionally two positions, workers advocates. They have tried to find a path for undocumented immigrants to become legal residents and citizens, while companies have pushed more for company groups have pushed more to try to expand this guest worker visa program to year-round jobs. Now, in the past month, I believe, or the past couple of months, workers groups and farm groups reached an agreement, consensus. As a result of that, there is a bill that has bipartisan support and has been filed in the U.S. Congress that it strikes a balance. On one side, it would provide a path to have a legal immigration status to undocumented immigrants who have been working for years as farm workers. And on the other side, it would may expand the guest worker program and make it available also to employers who need to cover year-round jobs.
Speaking of visa programs, you've also reported on a visa program meant for high-skilled workers that some dairy farms, it sounds like elsewhere in the country, are exploiting to get immigrant labor. They're getting veterinarian school graduates from Mexico and bringing them up for jobs. What do they find when they get here?
So, yes, this is something that happens, or at least we have some evidence that happens in Wisconsin, too. Wow. But we were not able to find a specific case where, like, the workers were willing to name the farm. But, yes, this is a visa program that is only targeting high-skilled workers for high-skilled jobs. And there are these veterinarians and engineers. They offer jobs as animal scientists in farms, supposedly in charge of nutrition programs, or to change other type of parents are good, make the farms more efficient and more productive. But then once they come here, what they find is that they are told to clean barns, to milk cows, or to do other sorts of jobs that don't require any sort of university qualifications or status. They are used just as general laborers.
Now, stepping back a little bit, let's talk about what's driving this. Farmers, as you say, are only paying fairly low wages for these farm workers, and it sounds like they can't afford to pay much more given things like low milk prices challenging them.
Correct. There is currently a crisis in milk prices. They have been down low for a very long time. And there are many small farms that are going bankrupt or getting out of business because they just can't simply afford to keep the business up with the prices they are receiving. You have larger farms that are doing better because of the scale that they have. And some of the small farms accuse the larger farms of flooding the market with milk and that in turn driving prices down. But yes, it's true that many farms are struggling to get by and are being hard-pressed. They cannot offer more pay to workers at a time where unemployment is very low, and even undocumented immigrants have other alternatives in industries like construction or factory work that are able to offer higher wages.
Maria, thanks a lot for sharing your reporting with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Maria Perez is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. She joined us to talk about her reporting on the experience of immigrant workers in Wisconsin's dairy industry.